Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 1st, 1999. In the fireside room this afternoon is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. Today's session is titled Globalization of the Economy and the Death of the Poor. Let's listen in.
My name is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. This is the third of five classes this week dealing with U.S. foreign policy in the specific context of looking at what I'm calling the Great Divide, this huge divide separating the rich and poor within and between nations. And just to help me, how many of you are here for the first time? Okay, quite a number of you. That's not a problem at all, but just so you know, in the first couple of sessions, we've focused in on that divide. For example, I gave a few statistics, not a lot, but about 60% of the world's people are living and dying on 6% of the world's resources, just to give you an idea of how divided we are. Economist Javier Garostiaga calls our global economy a champagne glass economy, in which all the wealth is floating to the top and is available to a very relatively small group of people with a huge amount of poverty and degradation for those who are at the bottom or looking at on the stem. Last time, in a session we didn't tape, and you could find out a lot more about this if you want to, and I think there's only one of these left, the book School of Assassins, which is a book I wrote about the U.S. Army School of the Americas, a U.S. military training school that was opened in Panama in 1946, was kicked out of Panama as part of the Panama Canal treaties, and then relocated where it is today at Fort Benning, Georgia. And to make a long story short, every major human rights atrocity in our hemisphere in the past 40 years has been carried out by graduates of this U.S. Army training school. Where we're going to pick up the story today is, if you were here last time and you saw this short video on the U.S. Army School of the Americas, you could have noted that among those who have been killed, among the very well-known people killed by soldiers trained at this school, were people like Archbishop Romero, the four U.S. church women. They were both killed in 1980. In El Salvador. And then November 1989, the Jesuit priests in El Salvador were murdered. And I could cite all kinds of studies if you want, or you can read in School of Assassins that there was, according to America's Watch and other human rights organizations, a very active, strong, directed campaign of repression and terror directed at the churches in El Salvador throughout the 1980s. So today we're picking up on the story of the relationship of the persecution of progressive religious and U.S. foreign policy. And the way that I would like to start this, and I'm going to introduce this in a way that involves you for a few minutes in a small group. And what I want to do is share with you what is an absolutely unthinkable situation and place you in that situation and ask you to make decisions. And what I want to tell you is that although this situation I'm going to place you in is unthinkable, it's real. It is an actual situation from the highlands of Guatemala. And so as hard as it is for us to move from this space to another mountainous area in Guatemala, I'm going to ask that you try to do that mentally and as best you can to shift yourselves from this place to a place I'm about to describe. So let me just tell you that in this role play that I'm giving you, that you are very poor and you are attempting to make a living by eking out some farming on the grudging hillsides in mountainous Guatemala. You are part of a strange and wondrous church in which you are celebrating your faith in the midst of incredible poverty and incredible repression. You gather together weekly and you open up the Bible and you read a text or have it read to you, and you try to think about what it means to be the people of God in the midst of hunger and poverty and political repression. The army is very well known to you. It has come nearby many times. It has, by its own count, burnt hundreds and hundreds of villages to the ground and sent people fleeing either within their own country or outside the country. If you are caught, some of you can think of yourselves as catechists or people who were lay people who were trained to do Bible study in your communities. And if you are caught carrying a Bible, caught with a Bible in your home, caught with the communion wafer which you bury beneath corn stalks and try to hide, but if you're caught with those things, your experience is that you will be tortured, killed, and have experienced a very ugly death. The military in this area, as I say, is very, very repressive. And this is the context in which you're trying to think about how you live out your faith in God. That's kind of the background. Here's the situation that I'm going to place you in, which is a real story. Is that imagine that you're all part of that village community that I've just described. And the Guatemalan army has just come to your village. And let's just say that I am a representative of that. And this is what I've done. I hand to you the names of six people on a list. And I tell you that by tomorrow morning, you must have these six people executed by members of their own families. And if you do not, then we will come back. I and my friends will come back and we will burn this village to the ground and we will burn all the neighboring villages to the ground. Well, you look at that list and what you see is the name of the six people, the six names on there, are your community Bible study leaders. That's who have to be killed. That's the directive that you've been given. Well, I'm going to ask that they shut off the tape for a minute while I give you a few minutes, and just would ask people who are listening on tape to put yourself in this situation, try to figure out, what are you going to do? Are you going to do what the army tells you to do? What are your options? And what are you going to do given this horrific situation that you've been placed in? So just turn to one other person, and what I'd like you to do is just spend a couple of minutes thinking about what are our options here? What are we going to do? The military says we've got to have these people killed by their family members by tomorrow morning, and if we don't, they're going to burn our village to the ground. We know they're capable of doing that. We know how repressive they are. What are we going to do? So I want you to think about your options, name as many as you can, and then see if you can agree upon what you would actually do. And then I will tell you what this community actually decided. And what we're going to do is just see what you came up with. First of all, what were just some of the things you considered?
Flee.
Yeah, leave. What else?
Assassinations.
What was that?
Hide your possessions in the jungle and then let them burn down.
Okay, hide your possessions, let them burn the ground. What do you do?
Warfare, gather people together.
Okay, try to get people together and fight back.
It's kind of fight or flight.
Uh-huh.
So you have some people that think about fighting and some people fleeing.
Two very realistic options, yeah.
And some people taking the kids out in the jungle, the rest of us figure they're going to be watching. Not very many people are going
to
get out.
So let some of the people get out and the others stay, but you didn't decide if they stayed and fought or just stayed and said we weren't going to do it or stayed and what?
They stayed and they're probably going to get killed.
Okay. Anybody else?
The six could just choose to martyr themselves.
Okay, the six could choose to go ahead and do it. Yeah, I hate this story, but what I... Yeah, go ahead. Another option.
See if there's some way you can get the message out, what's happening, the story. Even if it's only that in person.
So send someone out to just let people know that this is happening. Yeah. Well, this is a horrific story, and there's no good choices, it seems to me. And one of my purposes in telling this, presenting you with these awful choices, is I find that in a very few minutes, it makes our world seem a little more comprehensible. If you've ever asked yourself, why did a lot of Central Americans from El Salvador and Guatemala, what are they doing in the United States? Why did they come? Why all these refugees? Why would anybody ever pick up a gun and fight? In a few minutes, we can get a glimpse of how, in a sense, distant our lives on this end of empire is compared to people who have to deal with the daily threat of this kind of violence. Now, there is no right choice here. I'll just tell you that what the community decided was the community decided that they couldn't do it. They couldn't execute these six. And the six decided that they had to. And that, in fact, is what happened. Now, this would be, just for me, a powerful and graphic story. You can find it, by the way, in a book by Penny Lanoue. She starts out her book, a book called People of God, with this dilemma, with this story. But my wife and I lived in Central America in 1984 through 86, and we spent a fair amount of time back and forth there. And our community, the community of St. Martin, of which Kathleen and Robin and Ray McKeever and a number of people are here. We're from a common faith community in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. We did a lot of work with refugees, including opening up our homes to refugees and working to try to get political asylum for refugees throughout the 1980s. And one of the households, it wasn't, Sarah and I had people living with us, it wasn't these particular people, but several of the people in our homes were from Guatemala. And it turned out the two of these people were the Bible study leaders that replaced these six that had been killed. And within a very short time, the military came back, the threats continued, and so they fled. Now, to bring this to the topic of the day, which is to look at U.S. foreign policy in the context of persecution of the church, I would just like to point out to you two uncomfortable likely things here. The first is, it's very likely that these Guatemalan soldiers who committed these atrocities and made these threats and burned these villages had close ties to the United States, either through direct military training or after a point the U.S. cut off official military aid, but we continued to supply Guatemala to Israel. And we also maintained a very, very strong Central Intelligence Agency presence. And as recent documents, Truth Commission reports from Guatemala and other reports have indicated, many key graduates of the U.S. Army School of the Americas were in central power positions within essentially what functioned as the secret police, the death squads in Guatemala. So we are intimately tied to the soldiers that carried out these atrocities throughout many, many years in Guatemala, resulting in more than 200,000 people being killed. Now, the second really troubling thing, it seems to me at least, as if that wasn't troubling enough, is that it's very likely that the people who carried out these murders were Christians. These were Christian soldiers targeting and killing other Christians that, as I mentioned earlier, gathered around the Word of God, read the Bible, and tried to think about and act out their faith. And what does it mean to be a person of faith in the context of poverty and repression? And it's that piece of things that I want to try to make comprehensible today, is to look at why, what's going on. There's obviously different understandings of God, different understandings of faith, and they must be pretty provocative to spawn this kind of tension and response. And then I want to try to assess with you and share some thoughts with you about where the U.S. lined up in this struggle. Who did we support? Why did we support the soldiers that were carrying out this kind of violent war against other Christians? All right. Well, we'll do this hopefully fairly quickly and concisely at least. And just to remind you that the conquest, the arrival of the Spanish conquest what it came with was superior military power, and what else did it come with?
Christianity.
Christianity. It came with the Bible. And it came with a theology. And if we look at what happened during the colonial conquest, it's very clear that the first thing that Columbus and others were after was gold and silver, right? First they wanted that. And literally they set up systems where every day, or every week at least, if you were native peoples, where I as a Spanish person arrived, and I'm in power, I would give you a quota of gold that you had to come up with each week. And if you missed that quota, you got your hands cut off. Now, when it was clear that the gold was all gone, or that there wasn't a lot of it there, then the basis of wealth became the land. So you enslaved the people, you shifted land ownership away from communal holdings to big plantations, you made them the slaves to produce export crops. That became the basis of wealth. Now, I could go into more and more detail. It gives you a picture that colonialism was very profitable for some people and very, very painful for others. But the point I want to make here is that was all reinforced by God talk. It was reinforced by definitions and understandings of Christian faith, of theology. And I call that theology colonial theology, because it's theology that reflects those colonial, imperial, economic, exploitative values. And I just identified five features of this old theology. And first one was in that context of this huge divide between rich and poor that is very old, just deepening now. Poverty and wealth were understood as God's will. If you're poor, that's God's will. That's just the way it is. If you're rich, that's God's will. It's a very nice message if you happen to be rich, and not a very good message if you happen to be poor. Another part of it was obedience to authority. You obey civil authority, and you obey religious authority. A third one was there was a strict separation and understanding between body and soul, earth and heaven. And the reason this is important is literally this colonial theology oftentimes gave indigenous peoples a choice. You convert to Christianity or we'll kill you. Now, a lot of people converted. A lot of people didn't. And the way this theology could justify literally killing people and threatening to kill them so that they would confess Christ as Lord is because their theology said this is what matters. It's the soul that matters. These are savages who don't know God, and when they die, they're going to go to hell and they're going to live in eternity in hell unless we get them converted. And so it was okay to kill them and threaten them with death because you were after their souls. And the body-soul split somehow made that more palatable. It was a very individualistic theology. You know, still you can travel throughout Latin America and in this country too. A lot of people come up to you and say, do you know Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior? Have you been saved? What was the moment of your salvation? It's a very individualistic faith that replaced a very communal understanding of religion and God and the gods. And then, most importantly, I think, in some ways, was the last one, which was the pacifying promise of a heavenly reward. If you accept your lot in life, if you accept your poverty, if you obey authority, even if they happen to be killing you, then when you do die, if you do everything right, if you accept all this, then when you die, you go to heaven, and the streets of heaven are paved with gold. It's the pacifying promise of a heavenly reward. This is the theological context for a tremendous amount of justification for political repression, economic inequalities. Now, what we could maybe talk about a little bit is, it would be my contention that this theology is very much alive and well. And it's still very much a part of many of our faith traditions. It's still more central than some of us might like to think. Now, one other illustration that from my time in living in Central America was very, very interesting. If you were a wealthy, say I'm a wealthy landowner, and land traditionally was the basis of wealth through all Latin America. And I'm a wealthy landowner, and my wife gives birth to four sons, say a daughter too. The daughter can more or less do whatever she wants, well, not within very constricted. But if I have four sons, what do you think I'd want those four sons to do? Try to pick out four different things that I might, four different vocations or jobs that I would want my sons to be involved in if I'm a member of the wealthy elite in a Latin American country. Okay, priest.
Priest, land.
What was that?
Soldier.
Landowner.
Soldier.
I'll put that one in quotes and come back to it.
Landowner.
Landowner, uh-huh.
Politician.
Politics.
We'll put that one up here.
Merchant.
Yeah. Essentially, yep. You got it. Essentially, what I want is what I call the four pillars of power. Because the reason politician isn't up there is because politicians don't have any power. Politicians are fig leaves for those who control other things. And so a politician might make it into the big five, but it doesn't make it into the top four. So what you want your sons to do is you want them to be to cover the power bases of society. And those, very significantly, those four areas are: you want someone to manage your plantations, you want someone to diversify into business, you want someone, now soldier here has to be in quotes because you don't want your son ever to get near being shot, but you want them to be order other people into positions where they can get killed. So military leader. And the fourth one is priest. Well, why is priest up there? Priest is up there because within this traditional situation, the church is an instrument of the powerful. It's an instrument of power. It's an instrument of the powerful. So when I say that Christians are killing members of that community that I laid out, they are Christians whose understanding of what they're doing has been shaped by this theology, by this understanding of God, and it's largely being directed by people who use theology as an instrument of power, for the power. All right, well, I didn't write it up here yet, but I will. We're going to take a look at liberation theology. Liberation theology is a response to poverty, and it's a response to this old theology. Just a little bit of history. In the Catholic Church, there was a very important meeting that took place from 1962 to 1965. Some of you probably have heard of it, called Vatican II. The Pope called, Pope John, a very progressive Pope, called bishops from all around the world to the Vatican to really, essentially, to rethink the position of the Catholic Church in the world. And to greatly simplify, John was very, very concerned about issues of poverty. But the main preoccupation of Vatican II was that in Europe, Europe was progressing. Europe was getting richer. And in that context, people were saying, we don't need God anymore. So the main question of Vatican II was kind of, how can the church be relevant in a modern world, in a world of progress? So that was 1962 to 65. But after that, I mean, the best thing that came out of Vatican II was that it essentially invited the church to be in the world. Your job now, your primary job now, wasn't to help usher people from this world to the next world. The church was defined as an institution that was supposed to try to be involved in the world. That was very important. Well, in 1968, in Medellin, Colombia, the Latin American bishops had a meeting. And the Latin American bishops I know Gustavo Gutierrez was one of my professors. He's a liberation theologian from Peru. And he was a priest at this time, and he was working behind the scenes in Maine. So this is 1968, a few years later. And he says, historically, when the bishops got together for their bishops' conference, it was kind of a big party. And you'd get together, and the bishops, they would drink and talk, and it was just a kind of a great time, and you'd deal with a few issues on the side. Well, he and a bunch of others, and some bishops that took things a little bit more seriously than that, they worked really hard at Medellin, and they essentially in Medellin reshaped an understanding of the church. And a few bishops got caught off guard of what they had really signed on to a few years later, and they've been quite hostile to liberation theology. But Medellin said, in a nutshell, it said, well, thank you for inviting us into the world, Vatican II, but our world is not a world of progress. Our world is a world of misery. Our world is a world of injustice, a world where land is owned by the few, where poor people are dying all around us, and who the heck is God in the midst of that? And what is the role of the church in the context of poverty and repression? So, very quickly, let me just lay out a couple of very important features of liberation theology. The first thing to note is the method of liberation theology. And there are really four things to note. For us, if we take liberation theology, the first thing we're supposed to do is to insert our lives in the situation of the poor so we can actually understand what that reality is like. Now, liberation theology was in fact being done by people who were in impoverished communities like the one I described for you. So they didn't have to insert themselves. They're already there. But being real present, right, with the situation of the poor was the first thing. The second thing in the method of this is theology now, liberation theology, was social analysis. Asking the why questions. Why do 2% of the landowners in Latin America own 80% of the land, and why is it the best land? Why does the Salvadoran Constitution say every Salvadoran child has a right to an education, but schools are only available to the rich? Why, you know, does Juan Jose have control of my grandfather's land, et cetera, et cetera? What's going on in society that helps get at the causes of hunger and poverty and inequality? So social analysis. Then the next part in the process is Bible study. Doing what I suggested that community was doing, they would open up a text, they would read the Bible, and they would reflect on it. What does this mean for us to be people of faith? What does the Bible say? What is Jesus doing? Etc. And then, action. You didn't just learn this stuff because it was interesting, you learned it because you wanted to transform the world, because you wanted to live differently, because you wanted your communities to be different. And this becomes an ongoing process of reflecting and acting and reflecting and acting. So the method itself, you might imagine, I'll just give you a personal experience again. When Sarah and I were living in Central America, and we met with people in rural Honduras, it was very common, who had not been influenced by this methodology and the theology that I'm about to tell you about. You would ask them a question, they would look at their feet, they would go back and forth, and they would say things over and over. We are stupid, ignorant people who know nothing. We are like oxen who know nothing. Just a deep internal sense of internalization, of hopelessness, despair, worthlessness. If you visited people who had been impacted by liberation theology, what I'm going to talk about in a minute, but even this method of involving people in reflection about their own reality, they would look you in the face and they would engage you. Why is the United States funding these cultures who come and we build a cooperative and they destroy it? We build a health clinic and they destroy it. Why is that happening? Why are you allowing that to happen? Very different. I mean, very, very different. You had a sense of hope and possibility and dignity and a sense that there's stuff going on in the world now that we can name and know about and that we can do something about. And you have to be partners with us in that. But the very method of liberation theology, of involving people to think about their own reality, think of what's going on, and to invite them to say, it's not God's will. It's not God's will that your children are dying because you don't have a 10-cent vaccine. It's rooted in in societal choices. Okay. Well, basic tenets. So the basic, very basic, bare bones, what does liberation theology say? Well, I just named a couple of things here I'll put up. First one was it stressed the dignity of the human person. Now, that may not sound very radical, but given what I just said about people going like this and saying we are about doctrine who know nothing, to assert the dignity of the people is a really powerful thing. If any of you have seen the film Romero, powerful scene in the film Romero, when he looks out at these people, they've just retaken a church that the military had taken over, and he looks out at them and he says, "You are Jesus Christ on earth today." Well, that's pretty dignified. That's telling people, you are people of dignity. Now, the second feature of liberation theology was that there is a social responsibility that goes with this dignity. What I mean by that is, if we say that people have dignity by virtue of being creatures of God, then societies need to be structured in ways that allow for dignified living. And if 2% of the people own 80% of the land, a lot of people are going to be dying. It doesn't allow for dignified living. If schools are only available to the rich and not available to the poor, that doesn't allow for dignified living. If you have to make a choice about whether to sell your seed crop for next year or in order to have enough money to send your kid to the hospital or watch that kid die and then know that you're going to be hungry the next year, that doesn't allow for dignified living. So there's dignity, yes, but dignity also comes with a social implication. Another feature of liberation theology is it stressed God's preferential option for the poor. Jesus's and God's preferential option. Note that the word is preferential. It's not exclusive. It's not that the Word of God doesn't have anything to do with people who are comfortable or wealthy, but a preferential option for the poor. That God is most clearly to be found, and the church needs to be clearly involved where people are oppressed, where people are suffering. A preferential option of the poor. Another key feature was liberation theology talks about social sin, structural sin. That sin is not simply my personal behavior, although liberation theology doesn't deny that there is personal sin. But sin gets rooted in the very structures of society. And that liberation theology says that God wills for there to be freedom and wholeness for all creatures, for all people. And that means we have to address the social or structural aspects of sin. Another very important teaching of liberation theology concerns the spiral of violence. And I may talk more about this on Saturday. But let me just say that liberation theology here said we should all be concerned about violence, because violence is usually a destructive thing. But they said there's really three spokes in the spiral of violence. The first violence is hunger and poverty and oppression. The second violence is when poor people who are being crushed sometimes use violence in their resistance. So it's resistance. The third violence is repression of the state. The death squads, the military repression. And so what liberation theology said very clearly is it said the church, if it wants to be concerned about violence, which it should be, it should work to break the spiral of violence. And the only way you can break the spiral of violence is if you address violence number one. Is if you address the issues of hunger and poverty and oppression. And this is what really got liberation theology into a lot of trouble. Liberation theology also said, and the church had to break its alliance with the violence of the state. With the unjust violence of the state, of the death squads, of the militaries that are used to put down rebellion to maintain unjust systems. The church, again, if you saw the film Romero, one of the striking things about Romero is he refused to go and to be part of those national celebrations where the new military dictator was put in power. He refused to give the church legitimacy to that kind of violence and injustice. So this whole idea of the spiral of violence is another teaching in liberation theology. Another One, very important for us, it seems to me, is liberation theology says, in relation to these issues, individual people of faith and the church itself cannot be neutral. Because by claiming neutrality, we are involved with what is. We reinforce the injustice that is. So essentially it says all of us who are breathing are political actors. And if we choose to breathe and not do anything, we support the injustice that is. And so even in the midst of ambiguities, it said we have to make decisions as best we can about how do we live out a preferential option for the poor. Two last things. Liberation theology also said that the crucifixion of Jesus needed to be understood not as an atoning sacrifice, although some theologians didn't rule that out, that you could eventually get there, but first and foremost as a political execution. That Jesus was murdered, liberation theology says, as a consequence of his life and faith. So you have to ask yourself the question, who killed Jesus and why? And what you see, liberation theology says, is on page after page of the Bible, of the New Testament, is that Jesus is confronting the most powerful forces in his society. He's confronting the Romans, he's confronting the oppressive temple, he's confronting the large landowners, he's confronting a whole structure of violence and injustice, and for that he gets killed. Now, that's a very powerful message, it seems to me, to take seriously that Jesus is executed as a consequence of his life and his faith in God, and that that is what we are called to follow, is that life, that way of being. And the resurrection is then understood, among other things, within liberation theology, as the vindication of that way of life of Jesus. It's God's way of saying that the powers killed Jesus, but Jesus is still alive. What's the final threat that empires have? It's to kill you. And liberation theology says the resurrection tells us that death does not have the last word, does not have the final word. So in a nutshell, that's my brief summary of liberation theology. Any questions about this? Then I want to take just a few more minutes to describe how the U.S. regarded this theology and what it did in response to it, along with our military allies in Latin America. Yeah?
What is the criticism against the liberation theology?
Oh, the criticism against liberation theology would be, oh, it's too worldly. One criticism was, well, it spawns violence. And that's why liberation theology, in response to that charge, said, we hate violence. Violence is awful. Violence is destructive. That's why it introduced this idea of the spiral violence. Other criticisms this is class struggle. This is just Marxism with a religious face. And so you're promoting class divisions and dividing society. So you can't do this. It's upsetting the order of things ordained by God. Lots of things. Well, let me just go a little further so that we have some time to talk about the U.S. foreign policy part. Maybe I can do it without that. Let me just say a couple of things. If you were here yesterday, you saw the video on the U.S. Army School of the Americas, and you'll note that one of the Hall of Fame members of the SOA was Hugo Bonzer. Now, Hugo Bonzer was the dictator of Bolivia, and he, in the 1960s, in response to liberation theology, in response to, keep in mind, the church here, a segment of the church who followed this theology and embodied it in their community life, I don't know if you can imagine how offensive that would be to people who have relied upon the Bible and the church to bless and embrace an unjust order. Because it's challenging. It's challenging poverty. It's challenging the structures of society. And it's saying that the church and individual Christians can do something about that. Not only can, but must do something about that. Well, Hugo Bonser, the dictator of Bolivia, did not like this theology at all. And by the way, one other little aside. A lot of this theology grew out of the experience of indigenous priests and religious in Latin America. A lot of it also grew out of a real irony that following the Cuban Revolution in 1959, the Catholic Church, but other churches as well, issued this big plea, send religious workers to Latin America to save them from communism. And they came. The churches devoted huge amounts of money and lots and lots and lots of people came over to save the Latin Americans from communism. And what happened? When they got there, and after a few years, they said, wait a minute, I don't see communism. I see a few landowners controlling everything. I see people dying because they don't have a 10-cent vaccination. I see, that's one of the things that fed this rethinking of the church and of the theology. Well, Hugo Bonser was very upset about this, and he was a very good friend of the United States, and the Central Intelligence Agency was very active in Bolivia. And Bonser was one of the first people who, in conjunction with the United States, came up with a plan. It was known as the Bonser Plan. And the idea was to sow divisions within the church, to throw out of your country any of the foreign priests and other religious that were involved. Actually, Roy Bourgeois, who was featured in that video and was working really hard to close the U.S. Army School of the Americas, he was kicked out of Bolivia by Hugo Bonser. Here's an irony. And now he's back protesting the school that Bonser would have embraced. But part of the plan also included the terrorizing of the church and even the political murder of priests. And the reason the Bonser Plan is so important is because it also was one of the first real attempts to get the security agencies throughout Latin America that the United States had helped set up following World War II to really in close communication with each other about the specific dangers posed by the church. So this became part of a regional strategy of targeting the progressive religious as enemies. In 1980, who was elected in 1980 in our country? Reagan Bush. Their foreign policy platform was laid out in a report called the Committee of Santa Fe. It was a group of intellectuals and others who ended up, many of them in high positions in Reagan Bush cabinet. And they put out a blueprint about U.S. foreign policy, and essentially, you can get a lot of quotes from in here if you want. I just want to read one quote to you. But essentially what they said was, the United States was about to lose everything to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was taking over all of Latin America. We were next. And it was a very dangerous world, and we were done for unless we struck out in new ways and saved our position. But it also specifically targeted liberation theology. And this is one quote from that document. It says, U.S. foreign policy must begin to counter liberation theology as it is utilized in Latin America by the liberation theology clergy. Unfortunately, Marxist-Leninist forces have utilized the church as a political weapon against private property and productive capitalism by infiltrating the religious community with ideas that are less Christian than communist. Now, this is literally their strategy becomes a kind of blueprint for the stepped-up repression against the progressive churches throughout Latin America, and particularly in Central America, the countries of El Salvador, or the country of El Salvador. 1987, so we're a few years now into things. Romero's already been killed. The four U.S. churchwomen have been killed. A lot of just people that we don't even know their names, these catechists in various countries in Guatemala, El Salvador, and elsewhere, have been targeted for intense repression. And in 1987, apparently every year, or maybe it's every 2 years, I'm not sure, there's a meeting of the armies called the Armies of the Americas. And it brings together U.S. military leaders with military leaders from almost all the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean. Well, in 1987, they got together and they had, guess what the focus of their meeting was? Liberation theology. Their whole meeting. was their whole time together was outlining the dangers of liberation theology. And they named liberation theology as the number one threat to the United States and elite economic interests in Latin America. Not Marxism, liberation theology. And just some of you may be familiar with this name. The conference report specifically targeted Father Ayacuria. He was the head of this of the Jesuit University in El Salvador, who would be murdered in November 1989. The report specifically named him, and they defined him this way. He was one who consciously manipulated, quote, the truly liberating Christian message of salvation to further the objectives of the communist revolution. So Ayacuria was specifically named and targeted and killed 2 years later. I think what I'll do now is just stop and open it up for questions and conversation. Yes?
Well, we're saying now that communism is totally done away with. You go into Chiapas, you go into Colombia, where you're trying to get genuine reform, and there's no communist leaders stepping forth. There's some rebels that want their, they don't want to be slaughtered.
Well, this is what makes Chiapas so important for us to pay attention to. And I mentioned yesterday that, or a couple times ago, that an earlier book that I wrote about U.S. warfare strategy in Central America called War Against the Poor is now being translated by people working with the church in Chiapas because they say that's our reality now. That's what's happening here. And you have Romero-type figures in Chiapas who are in grave danger. And they would say that the Zapatistas are communists and that the church is serving as their cover. So the same ideology that gave rise to a kind of blanket repressive policy that these progressive churches are part of a communist conspiracy are exactly the ones that are at play in Chiapas. More frightening to me, or as frightening to me, is that I recently debated a lieutenant colonel from the School of the Americas at Georgetown University about the nature of the school. And at that debate, he was absolutely unapologetic for the U.S. war against the religious. He had no time at all for any differentiation in his mind or policy. They were simply a subversive element that the U.S. had to counter. And I picked off, you can do this yourself if you want, I picked off a couple days ago before I came here, off the official webpage of the School of the Americas, U.S. Army School of the Americas. You can look it up, just go on the World Wide Web, those of you who have access. And this is what this is what they're sending out to the public to try to defend themselves against criticism. And it's called Frequently Asked Questions. And this question was, why the controversy over the school? And here's how they answer it. According to leaders of the movement, the controversy has nothing to do with the School of the Americas nor its graduates, but rather with U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. Now, I've been very clear, or I was last time, that the issue for me is the foreign policy of the country, but I don't know that we can make any artificial divide here. We have to see the school in the context of a policy. It goes on to say, or this answer goes on to say, the school is the easiest target for those people who do not believe in the necessity for a military or police force, or for those who do not want to see the success of democracy in the region. Many of the critics supported Marxism / liberation theology in Latin America, which was defeated with the assistance of the U.S. Army. Now this is a very troubling piece for me for many reasons, but the debate that I had with this gentleman indicated to me that they still firmly believe that anyone associated with a theology that says the Christians have to take poverty seriously and the social roots of poverty seriously are in their minds still defined as subversives, whether communists or others. That there's no sense of honesty or repentance about that. And that this pattern will repeat itself in places like Chiapas because of that mindset. Very troubling. Yes?
Does the financial support for the School of the Americas, is that part of the Pentagon budget?
Yes, and it's being there's a specific line item for it that's being lifted up. There is a bill to close the U.S. Army School of the Americas. I don't have my bill number, but what I will put up here before I leave now is I'll put up the website address and the actual address of School of America's Watch. And you can get right on there and it will tell you the bill numbers. There's a House bill and there's a Senate bill. But the effort is to cut off the funding for the school through a bill that says that's exactly what it's going to do. That bill has never been allowed to be voted on. It's never, the Republicans will never, they never let it out of committee onto the floor. So the best that's happened so far is amendments have been offered to larger military appropriations bills to delete an amount of money that would effectively close the school down. So, but it is approved as part of, generally as part of a specific funding bill for the school as part of larger appropriations for the military budget. Yes?
Two questions. Reagan's been out for a long time, so what are the policies since then? And what about the Vatican and the Pope? Because they must have vested interests in Latin America.
Very good questions. Two quick responses to the first half. Reagan's been gone for a long time. What's the policy sense? Well, the policy sense is that the U.S. Army School of the Americas remains open. I think that's the simplest statement of continuity in policy. The Clinton administration supports the school remaining open. There is a major effort, major movement around the country to get it closed. The ELCA is a part of the groups who are trying to get it closed. But the policy, I think, remains pretty much in place. And there's no apology for what we've done in the past and really no acknowledgement of what we've done in the past. Now, I said, if you weren't here the last time, what I said the last time was that, and I'll talk more about this next time, tomorrow, is that in many places in the world, the U.S. relies less upon political repression and more upon economic leverage to get what it wants. But in the situations where that's not true, and I would cite two examples, Colombia and Mexico in particular, these old policies are very much still in place and supported. Now, the last part of your question was what again?
The Pope and the Vatican.
The Pope and the Vatican, very good. This book I mentioned, I started you out with that scenario, that awful scenario in which you had to decide what to do, comes from a book called People of God by Penny Lanoue. And what her book is about is that essentially at the same time that the United States and its military allies were waging a military war against progressive religious forces throughout Latin America, that the Vatican was waging a different kind of war. And that war took the place, it took the form of appointing right-wing bishops and cardinals, transferring progressive priests, and working quite hard to undermine these base Christian communities, these small groups of people, their Bible study groups. And what her book was about, it not only documents that the Vatican, although it was forced in a number of later conferences after Medellin to acknowledge the legitimacy of liberation theology while pointing out some dangers, but basically acknowledge the legitimacy of it. In form of practice, this Pope has done a great deal to undermine the progressive church through appointments, through transfers, through silencing of key voices that were part of this theology. So it's a really tragic thing. And what Penny Lanoue says in this book is that that's one of the reasons the more right-wing fundamentalist churches are growing so rapidly in Latin America, is because these base Christian community movements are small gathering places. They're places where people can gather, they can share their faith, they build community. And by undermining those, it creates that space gets filled somewhere. And where it's been filled, in part, has been through these fundamentalist movements, which, by the way, there's probably evidence that the United States has been very grateful for that and has probably even helped support some of those movements, because that theology says it's that old theology to a T. So the Catholic Church hierarchy has not been, now publicly it will say, yes, liberation theology is okay, But in terms of the actual practice of this pope, which is really ironic, comes out of his experience in Poland, I think. It's ironic that this pope in some ways has spoken out most strongly against violence and war, and in some ways has strongly spoken out against the globalization of the economy and the impact on the poor. But his actual practices and impact on the church has been to undermine those churches most involved in working on issues of poverty.
There was actual linkage between Reagan and the Pope. I mean, they felt a symbiotic relationship almost, from both of them surviving assassination. And I think they were also eager to bring down and crush communism.
Yeah.
Is the Pope just a personification of Reagan's policies?
Well, I wouldn't say it's that, because as I say, this pope is a really mixed bag. But I think his experience in Poland and what happened to the church there and other things made him very, very suspicious of communism. I mean, he was very prone, as Reagan was, to see a communist everywhere. But he's not Reagan-like at all in the sense that, for example, the pope has come out since the Gulf War and said there is no such thing as a just war. The Pope has come out very strongly against the economic embargoes against Cuba and Iraq. The Pope has spoken out very harshly against international capitalism and its impact on the people. So those are all things that you wouldn't find Reagan doing. So I think we have, I just look at the Pope as a real hard person to figure out. But on some issues, it seems to me he's saying exactly the things that need to be said, but I think he's got some real blinders on other things that result from his particular experience of Poland that have been, over the long term, I think it will be a disastrous legacy for the Catholic Church. Because what's happening in Latin America today is that liberation theology is, it's not a completely defeated movement, but it's certainly... It didn't survive that repression very well. It was an unbelievable attack and a very effective one on some levels. And so I would say now there's a regrouping period among the more progressive church that's involved with the poor, largely around issues of community survival at this point. And we'll see what turn it takes eventually. Yes?
Did you happen to read the article in the Sunday Times about what the Clinton administration is planning to do in Yugoslavia?
No.
You need to read it. It's very telling of what the Clinton administration is planning on doing as far as using the CIA and all these agencies to undermine the government there. I mean, whether we like the government or not, you really have to read
it. Was it in this Sunday's paper? Or?
Seattle Times.
Is it over? I wonder if we get that here.
It's here.
Okay.
That's where I read it.
All right.
It starts on the front page, and I think it's A19, where it lists all of the ways that he plans on dealing.
Thank you. I will definitely look at it. I know we're just about out of time. Let's take one more quickly and go back here and see.
The people that I knew in Mexico that were indigenous people were in fact communist, not Marxist though, but they held things in common. They were purely communist. So if you're going to defend people, don't worry if someone brings that up, that they want to hold land in common like that is some huge crime, you know, that happened in Russia, and look what happened. But that was a different system, that was an enforced system, as opposed to, a traditional system.
Thank you. Yeah, there's essentially, communism has become such a powerful word to us, and obviously there were some very bad things about communism in a lot of places. But it's become such a sweeping word for us that we can neither entertain the idea that there are differences in different places where communist isn't a word that gives you a license to kill. And that's the way it's been treated, I think, largely. Well, we'll formally bring this session to an end, and I will put up and just leave on the board here the address and the website for School of America's Watch, because that is one very clear, tangible place where these issues are being addressed. And this sounds pipe dreamish, But I believe, and there's actually some conversation going on, I believe that the country in the world that most needs a truth commission is our own. And we really need to push forward on these issues, because if we don't, these patterns will repeat themselves and continue to repeat themselves elsewhere. So thanks a lot. Tomorrow we're going to pick up on some of the global economic issues and how they relate to U.S. foreign policy.
What time is the class tomorrow?
Same time. Thank you.